stories. The channel that tells you scary stories.
Scary Stories by Peter Bernard. Not your average Ouija board story. Read by Madeleine Starr. I haven't owned or used a Ouija board for over 3 years now. But when I was 15, 16, 17, I owned several and nearly always carried one with me in my backpack. My friends and I all owned copies of the Satanic Bible and figured we were like apprentice devil magicians or something. It was me, Allison, Keisha, and Gretchen, or the Four Muscatels, as my idiot father used to call us. We would go out to this place in the forest, planning on summoning demons or some crap like that, but usually we'd just sit down there with the Ouija board instead. Our favorite place to go was this abandoned one-room cabin in the woods, where we knew for a fact that a lady had been killed back in the 1940s or 1920s or something. She was torn to shreds in a way that nobody had ever seen or heard of before. The story goes that the cops at the time were split on whether she was attacked by a human or an animal, or even what kind of animal. Every time we used the Ouija board at the abandoned cabin, we'd get different characters talking to us each time. Or at least they'd give us different names each time. Every second or third session, though, we'd get this entity that referred to itself as Wemo. Wemo, besides giving us his stupid-sounding name, was only able or willing to answer questions in a yes or no fashion. Over the course of 3 summers, we had learned that Wemo claimed to be the spirit not of anyone who had died at that place, but the spirit of the imaginary childhood friend of the woman who had been murdered here. He yes or no'd us until we grasped his narrative that although the girl had stopped seeing him anymore when she got to be around 5 years old, he stuck around watching her grow, and even after she was an adult. He told us how she was raised by her mother, and the two lived dirt poor alone in that shack. Like I said before, we did Ouija everywhere back then, from 4 to 6 nights a week in the summer, but the only location where Wemo came to call on us was the abandoned cabin in the woods. So we, among ourselves, started calling it Wemo's cabin. No wonder my brother and my classmates all said we spoke our own secret language. I guess in a way, we did. One time we headed out to the woods as a trio. Gretchen's real dad had disobeyed the order of protection and broken in on Gretchen's stepdad and mom. He beat them both up pretty badly. So Gretchen was at the hospital and obviously couldn't hang out with us. It felt weird without her. And Keisha flat out said we should just go to one of our parents' homes and play a board game or watch a comedy on YouTube. I had to admit that it didn't feel like a night to be toying around with this kind of thing. But Allison made fun of us in a way that got us both laughing and feeling stupid. Once the mood was lightened, we joked around and sang songs with lyrics changed to make fun of each other, and we headed deeper and deeper into the woods. I was doing my impersonation of Adele if she sang in a death metal band, when Keisha pointed out that she didn't recognize which part of the woods we were in. Suddenly, we all realized that we were lost. Keisha got really loud and bossy, I guess to hide her fear. She started cursing at us that we should have listened to her and not come out here. It was getting dark fast. That, coupled with Keisha's panicking, was making my heart beat too fast. So I focused on breathing more slowly with each breath. Allison spoke quietly, trying to calm us both, and pointed out that all we had to do was follow the setting sun and we'd be home, since we all knew my dad's place was west of the forest. That was true, and Keisha immediately started walking quickly toward the west. "Wait up!" shouted Allison. "Before we go, let's just have one quick Ouija session. Unless you're too chicken..." Allison crossed her eyes and stuck her tongue out, making her hands like claws, and started marching zombie-like toward Keisha. When she reached her, she started tickling her all over. "Zombie forest monster must tickle Keisha, must tickle." Keisha consented to one Ouija session if Allison agreed to never tickle her again. And I quickly had the board and planchette out and set up. I didn't want to say it out loud, but I just wanted to get this done and get the hell out of here. Allison asked if anyone was present, and very quickly and forcefully, we got the letters W-E-E-M and O, or WEMO. We asked him if we were by the cabin, and he said no. We asked him if he had something to do with us getting lost, and he said yes. The three of us scolded him outright, looking up and cursing at the air, as though he were above us or something. We were just pissed off that he would do that. None of the three of us even doubted that he was real anymore. I guess, judging by our reaction. After we had calmed down, Keisha ordered us to touch the planchette, and she asked what this place was that he had brought us to. The Ouija spelled out B-H-N-D-U. The three of us looked at each other quizzically. I was sitting across from Keisha and was about to ask her what she thought that meant when I saw it. "Behind you," I said, pointing behind Keisha. We were all sitting there, looking at it. It was naked. It was not a man, but it was not an animal. Everything about it was wrong. Even its center of balance was wrong. There was no way it should be standing upright the way it was bent both backwards and to the side like that. Its skin sometimes melted off of it, and he would catch it just in time to stick it back on. That was impossible. Nothing about it was possible, and everything about it was sickening. It reared back and screamed in a bubbly but incredibly loud voice. I have no idea what it was trying to say. Its vocal cords were probably melting and reforming, the same as the rest of it. I don't remember getting up to run, but I remember us finally clearing the edge of the forest and racing toward the trailer community we lived in. I don't remember if I was with my friends or not, but I remember us hugging each other on my bed inside, wondering if we were safe. I remember asking if the door was locked and being told that I'd already asked that question 100 times. When my dad and brother came home later, we told them the story and they laughed at us. Even so, they both drove us to Allison's parents' place in the city, and we girls slept over there. For the first time in my life, I felt safer in the city than in the country. The next morning, Allison's mom told me and Keisha how sorry she was about Gretchen, and that we should both feel free to stay with them in the city for the remainder of the summer. There were only about 10 days left anyway, so we took her up on the offer. After about 3 days of living downtown, it started to feel like we had dreamed or imagined everything that happened in the woods that day. We went out walking every day in the city, just amazed at how many things you could come across to do without even planning ahead at all. Yet even in the middle of all those shops and theaters and parks and cute guys, we still ended up, after a few more days, pulling out the old Ouija board again. Like I said, it really had come to feel like we might have imagined or exaggerated what happened to us, and the three of us were just having so much fun. So I set up the board, and Keisha starts to ask if anyone is there. Before she can even finish the question, the planchette starts spelling out W-E-E-M. We never let it finish. We threw the board, the planchette, and the box they came in out and took the can to the curb. Then we went back inside and watched a comedy on YouTube. The end.
Bland Man by Peter Bernard. Read by P.Q. River. A few years back, I became part of an online filmmakers collective. We started a project to collect wild sound, or background audio, from areas we lived in for the members from other parts of the world to share. This way, I could use audio from Bangkok while people in Denmark could play the sounds of New York cabs beeping in the films they made. One lovely autumn evening, I walked down the west side of Central Park recording and enjoying the sights and sounds. That is, I enjoyed it until this guy started walking along at the same speed as me, but slightly behind. He was keeping a pace too close to mine, like Romulans dogging the Enterprise, and it was making me uncomfortable. I decided to walk faster and put some distance between me and him, but then he sped up as well. This really got me annoyed, so I stopped short, make a right, walked to the edge of the sidewalk, and leaned against a phone pole. Pretended to be interested in my phone and give him a chance, you know, to walk on. Except he didn't. Instead, he went to the light pole just past my phone pole, and he also pretended to be doing stuff with his phone. This was a bit much for me, so I started glaring at him. I studied his appearance. He looked like someone with a job, very bland and nothing about him out of the ordinary. At first, I thought he was Caucasian, but then I wasn't sure. He was somewhat light-skinned, but had a tan. That's about all I could say for certain. His hair was dark and short, and he had no facial hair. Just the absolute least interesting features I'd ever paid attention to in my life. He was shorter than me, thinner, non-threatening in all ways, except for the fact that this utterly ordinary-looking stranger was apparently stalking me. He noticed me glaring at him, and I saw a flash of some sort of emotion on his face before he decided to walk on, which is what I'd been hoping he'd do for a while now. I stood there for a few more minutes, wanting to give him plenty of time to go on his merry way. I kept wondering why he was following me like that. I mean, didn't seem like he was gay or flirting with me, so what was his deal? I committed his appearance to my memory, and when I cautiously began walking again, I decided to keep an eye out for him the rest of the way home. Pullover sweater, shirt underneath, docker-type pants, a really boring kind of guy. I saw one like him on every block and found myself squinting at strangers to make certain they weren't him. Starting to really bum me out when I realized I was being ridiculous and getting paranoid. I picked out some loud music on my phone, laughed, turned up the volume on my earbuds, and decided to just go home. Then I saw him. Only it wasn't him, but it was. This time, he was a woman, and she was staring at me. That's impossible, I corrected myself. It must be that she just resembled the guy, and the reason she was looking at me was probably because I was staring at her in shock. It occurred to me I'd better keep a poker face the rest of the way home. I walked past and didn't look at her anymore. In fact, I don't know what I was looking at because a few minutes later I walked straight into a guy wearing a denim jacket, look up to apologize, and saw it was him. It was the guy who'd been stalking me. Only now he was dressed completely different in jeans and, Converse sneakers. His hair was longer and he was smirking at me. He said something that I couldn't hear because my music was too loud. I tried to get around him, but wherever I turned, he moved to block my path. I basically walked through him to run out into traffic, and I hailed a cab in the southward lane that was almost about to pass us. I dove inside, locked the door, shouted my address to the driver. We just got through the light before it changed, and we're out of the scene very quickly. Look out the rear view mirror and couldn't see the guy anywhere. The entire way home, I kept looking at the people we drove past and nobody looked like them. After a while, I tried to imagine that they did look like them. I wanted to see if this was something I could be imagining and projecting, you know. I wasn't ever able to duplicate the experience no matter how hard I tried. The cab driver kept trying to make small talk, but I was too caught up in what I was doing to actually understand anything of what he was saying. When we got to where I lived, I owed him $5.50 plus a tip. I had a $20 in my pocket, and I needed to calculate how much change they asked for. While doing math in my head, I finally look at the guy who had driven me home. It's him, the stalker. I toss him the 20 and jump out of the cab, walking quickly to the corner. I was intent on going around the block instead of inside so that he wouldn't find out where I lived. It dawned on me that I had actually said my address out loud to him, but even so, I walked around the neighborhood for 20 minutes before sneaking in one of the back entrances and heading upstairs to, calm down. Never seen anything resembling this man since, and I haven't had any experience even vaguely like this again, at least so far. Most of the time when I think back on this experience, I chalk it up to me misinterpreting the intentions of the first guy, followed by me running into his relatives who were in from out of town for one night only. Hey, makes as much sense as any other explanation.
UFOs and the Men in Black. Who are these strange men in black who have become so much a part of the unexplained aerial phenomena? Are they military agents? Do they represent a secret government? Or are they the entities themselves? Over the years, I have collected a vast array of cases related to the Men in Black. There are many types of actual entities or Men in Black that I've seen. John Keel, who has investigated these Men in Black cases throughout the United States back in the 1960s while he was investigating a huge flap that was taking place throughout West Virginia and North Carolina, said that he encountered stories of these strange MIB beings on many occasions while interviewing witnesses. These strange individuals have been known to warn UFO witnesses not to reveal what they had seen long before the case was even made public. Keel comments on the activities of these Men in Black by pointing out that many different investigators in flap areas have had experiences with the Men in Black, and only a small percentage of these cases have ever been published. There are several different types of Men in Black, Keel notes. One group appears to be more psychic or hallucinatory than real. They appear and disappear suddenly in bedrooms, and the witnesses often experiences paralysis or a sudden rise in temperature during their presence. We now have dozens of cases in our files of these types of Men in Black. Another type, now common throughout the U.S., is represented by men who travel in pairs. The same description is always given. One is tall and blonde, usually with a crew cut, fair-complected, and seems to be Scandinavian. His companion is shorter, with angular features and a dark olive complexion. The blonde usually does most of the talking while the other remains in the background. There seems to be several identical pairs of these individuals operating simultaneously in several states. Other types of Men in Black include men with dark complexions, slight stature, and a heavy, undefinable accent. These men sometimes pose as salesmen or poll takers. The witnesses usually regard them as a little strange, but think nothing further about them. Always ask witnesses if you're investigating a UFO in case if they have recently received any unusual visitors or salesmen, but do not try to offer any descriptions. See what they actually have to say. See if the witnesses can collaborate descriptions as to what I've just described. Naturally, every stranger is not to be taken for a Men in Black. Other types of Men in Black include dark complexion, dark-haired females of about 18 years of age. Other MIB types pose as photographers and offer to take free photos of the witness's entire family. These MIB use various types of vehicles, including the well-known black Cadillacs and other cars, including assembly line Fords and Volkswagen. White station wagons have now been mentioned in a number of widespread incidences. This is what Keel tells me about his field research involving the Men in Black. In any case involving the Men in Black, researchers should not attempt to apprehend them alone. Do not attack them physically. Approach them with great caution. They frequently employ hypnotic techniques collect adequate testimonial evidence before reporting them to the local police or FBI. You must prove that these individuals are breaking the law before the authorities can take any action. In the case where the MIB dress in military uniform, researchers should contact local Air Force or military bases and determine the validity of their identification. In several cases, the Air Force impersonators have adapted the names of existing officers but changed the rank. Thus, when you check out a Colonel Robert Withers, you will find that a Lieutenant Robert Withers is actually stationed nearby and knows nothing of the incident. Concluding, Keel points out that a large proportion of all the available UFO literature is based upon hearsay and speculation, that many of the real and important problems have been suppressed at the source by the witnesses themselves or have been ignored by the superficial investigators who were concentrating on obtaining descriptions of the objects rather than studying all the events and factors surrounding the sightings. A massive body of sighting data has now been published but has gone uncollected. Many of the aspects which have occupied ufologists for years have proven to be misleading or have failed to contribute to a better understanding of the whole of the phenomena. UFOs represent only a small part of the much larger phenomena which is now occurring on a worldwide basis. Investigating the history of UFOs, we find that the Men in Black have been with us for a long time. There are many cases throughout the investigation of psychic phenomena that include reports of these strange individuals. We don't know who the Men in Black are, but they are threatening. They have harassed witnesses, and we should be warned to be very careful when dealing with them, for they are the Men in Black, agents of terror.
Thank you, Tim. That was Tim Beckley, famous Timothy Green Beckley from UFO publishing fame. If you want to hear Tim, he's got his own channel, Mr. UFO's Flying, Mr. UFO's Secret Files, that's what it's called, on YouTube. And he's got hundreds of scary stories that are all 100% true on that channel. All the stories in this episode are true, supposedly, according to the people who first told them to me. But this next one was told to me by my father, and he most definitely thought it was real. I'm out walking in New York City, and it's the night of the full moon. The moon looks huge, and I decided I should start this new series on the full moon so I can tell this story in the first episode. Back before I was born, back in the 1950s, my father had a job in the day working in the factory in the Bronx, a factory of some sort. And at night, he was a cab driver. And the Bronx, if you don't know it, is a borough north of Manhattan in New York City. Okay, so one night he's at the taxi dispatch, and the guys all start laughing. They get a phone call and they start laughing, and they assign him the job. And he's like, "What are you laughing about? What's so funny?" And they're like, "Nothing, nothing. Just this guy only calls once a month, and he only calls on the full moon." And my dad's, he was really superstitious about the full moon. So he was like, no, you're hooking me up with some weirdo or something like that. And they were just laughing. He's like, "Well, if you don't want the job, you can quit." So he's like, all right, I'll take it. So he goes out and he picks up the guy at his home, and he looks sort of normal at first. He doesn't look crazy at first glance. But when he gets into the cab, he's really tense, he's really stressed out, and my father's starting to get freaked out and starting to get a little scared of the guy. And he's starting to like look at him, try and size him up. Do you think he has weapons on him? What's going to happen here? And the guy keeps insisting my father drive faster. And my father looks at the address where he's going to, and he realizes that's right by Woodlawn Cemetery. So he's like, "Well, hey, buddy, you going to Woodlawn Cemetery? It's the middle of the night. They're not going to be open." It's like, "Is there something?" He's like, "Shut up. Just drive." So my father's driving, and he's not happy about it, but he's doing it, and he wants to get this over with. And he finally gets to the location, and the guy jumps out of the cab without paying his fare, leaps over the fence into Woodlawn Cemetery, and next thing my father knows, he's hearing howling like a huge wolf And I was like, well, Dad, that was the guy. You know, he probably just thought he was a werewolf. He's like, no, he was a werewolf. My father was convinced to the day he died that he drove a werewolf in the back of his cab that night. And he said he went back to the dispatcher and he yelled at all of them that they could have gotten him killed. And they were just laughing and laughing. And he didn't see the humor in it. And I was like, well, maybe it was just a crazy guy, Dad. Or maybe it was even not a crazy guy. Maybe it was just one of their friends that they put up. Maybe they haze all the new guys this way. You ever think about that? And he's like, no, don't joke about this. And he was really angry. He was like, that guy was a werewolf. Werewolves are real. You watch your ass, because they're everywhere. Anyway, so if any of these stories were even mildly entertaining, feel free to subscribe or like or whatever, and we'll see you probably next week.
Come back for more scary stories.